We would like to begin our presentation with a song, No One Is Alone. It's a very UU song, I believe, although I don't know if Stephen Sondheim had that in mind when he wrote it for Into the Woods. So you will hear a few fairy tale references, witches and so on, but I think we can make the transfer to our situation.
It's a real pleasure to be here in Bozeman. Thank you for having us. I want to offer a special thanks to Sandra for hosting us and to our family, Susan Paul, and our newly discovered family, Allie and Amanda, their nieces who celebrated with us last night as we arrived in Bozeman. And to you, the fellowship, for your great open UU hearts. I look out and I see familiar faces, even though I've never met you before. I thought I'd tell you a little bit about Bozeman and Boone, just to give a context for who we are, how we live, and what we do, and with our fellowships. Bozeman is about three times Boone's size. So Boone is about 15,000. We read that you're about 45, but that's the official word, and we know there's more around us. We are both very cool mountain towns. Bozeman is at 4,700 feet. We're at 3,300 in the middle of the Appalachians, almost to Virginia, almost to Tennessee. So up in the far northwest corner of North Carolina. This fellowship and the Boone Unitarian Universalist Fellowship were founded within 5 years of each other. You folks in the late 50s, us in the early 60s, a couple people got together in each other's houses back in those days, and eventually we now have a fellowship building, and Sandra was a big part of its growth, serving as president also. You are now about twice the size of our fellowship, so we look at you with envy. Both we read are welcoming congregations, and I congratulate you for that. It has served us so well as we try to walk our walk, serve our mission. Both feature lay leadership, including opportunities for members like us to speak and present. Boone UU has many idiosyncratic traditions, and I've already seen a couple of them here. So in great UU tradition, we do that. In our words and music this morning, Linda and I are searching for ways to understand and champion compassion for others, following especially to our first UU principle. As we've read about the topic of compassion, we've seen a continuum of human interaction that moves from apathy to pity, to sympathy, to empathy, to compassion. However, writings about these ways of expressing and acting often demonstrate overlapping uses of the terminology. In fact, you'll hear in our next musical selection of Langston Hughes's use of pity. He speaks of pity when one might well interpret his use of it as a poetic substitution for compassion. It's a more apt rhyme, of course, for the word city. First, though, a reading from social psychologist Alan Schwartz in his essay, Compassion versus Empathy. Sympathy, empathy, and compassion are most positive, but there are some problems with the first two. Sympathy carries with it more than a small dose of pity for the other. Of course, the problem with pity is that it strongly implies a superior attitude to the one in pain or need. In other words, it is never helpful to feel sorry for the other person. Empathy for the plight of others is very positive and powerful. In it, the empathetic person is able to imagine being in the place of the troubled person and feel what they feel. In fact, empathy precedes compassion. Empathy without compassion leaves the individual drained of energy as a result of feeling what the other feels. Empathy occurs immediately and leaves no emotional room between the individual and the one who is suffering. Compassion is more cognitive in nature. There is a sense of self-awareness that provides some necessary space between the two people. The empathizer experiences the same suffering with the other, leaving the empathizer overwhelmed. As a result, compassion allows the individual to be more helpful than the individual who experiences empathy alone. None of this implies that there is anything wrong with empathy, of course. Simply put, we need a combination of both empathy and compassion to be most helpful to people.
This song, Litany, is a setting of the Langston Hughes poem set by composer John Musto.
Thank you.
One of the motivators for this service was the Book of Joy, which some of you may be familiar with. It describes most of a week that the Dalai Lama and his good friend, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, spent together to celebrate the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. This was 3 or 4 years ago. And I had several takeaways from this book. I found it to be very, very meaningful. One is that these two are incredibly playful and childlike when they're together. They're dear, dear friends. It's charming. Another is that they see joy. This was their task for the week, was to look at the idea of joy. They clearly see joy and compassion as inextricably linked. It's a circle. Having joy enables you to give compassion. Giving compassion brings you joy. The book describes the virtuous cycle of cultivating joy and happiness for oneself and for others. The more we turn toward others, the more joy we experience. And the more joy we experience, the more we can bring joy to others. The goal is not just to create joy for ourselves, but, as the Archbishop poetically phrased it, to be a reservoir of joy, an oasis of peace, a pool of serenity that can ripple out to all those around you. And the Dalai Lama talks about making the effort to make compassion a daily part of life. He says, "I think if you are an intensely religious believer, as soon as you wake up, you thank God for another day, and you try to do God's will. For a non-theist like myself, but who is a Buddhist, as soon as I wake up, I remember Buddha's teaching, the importance of kindness and compassion, wishing something good for others, or at least to reduce their suffering. Then I remember that everything is interrelated, the teaching of interdependence. So then I set my intention for the day, that this day should be meaningful. Meaningful means, if possible, serve and help others. If not possible, then at least not to harm others. That's a meaningful day." A song with a text by Emily Dickinson and music by Gary Schocker.
If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain.
It seems natural and is most of the time easy to have compassion for those we love and for those whom we see as oppressed. But how can we have compassion for the oppressors? How can we acknowledge the inherent worth and dignity of those who do not acknowledge it in others? I think this is one of the greatest challenges that we have. And I certainly won't claim to be successful. Again, from the Book of Joy, the Dalai Lama says, generally, when we speak of cultivating compassion for someone, we are cultivating compassion for someone who is actually undergoing acute suffering and pain. But you can also develop compassion for someone who is creating the conditions for their own future suffering. In our view, those people who are committing atrocities, including murder, are creating karma that brings very serious negative consequences. So there are many reasons to feel a sense of real concern for their well-being. When you have a sense of concern for their well-being, then there is no place for anger and hatred to grow. Both the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were clear about this, however. Forgiveness does not mean you forget what someone has done. Forgiveness does not mean that you do not seek justice or that the perpetrator is not punished. They tell a story of Anthony Ray Hinton, who spent 30 years on death row for a crime that he did not commit. He spent 30 years in a 5-by-7-foot cell in solitary confinement, allowed out only 1 hour a day. Hinton said, "I was angry. But going into the fourth year, I heard a man in the cell next to mine crying. The love and compassion I had received from my mother spoke through me and asked him what was wrong. He said he had just found out that his mother had passed away. I told him, look at it this way, now you have someone in heaven who's going to argue your case before God. And then I told him a joke and he laughed. Suddenly, my voice and my sense of humor were back. For 26 long years after that night, I tried to focus on other people's problems. And every day I did, I would get to the end of the day and realize that I had not focused on my own. Hinton was eventually released. When he was interviewed on the TV show 60 Minutes, the interviewer asked whether he was angry at those who had put him in and kept him in jail. He responded that he had forgiven all the people who had sent him to jail. The interviewer incredulously asked, "But they took 30 years of your life. How can you not be angry?" Hinton responded, "If I'm angry and unforgiven, they will have taken the rest of my life." Some of you may also have read or heard about some communication from Ari Mahler. Ari Mahler is a nurse. As he describes in a Facebook post that went viral, "I am the Jewish nurse. Yes, that Jewish nurse, the same one that people are talking about in the Pittsburgh shooting that left 11 dead, the trauma nurse in the ER that cared for Robert Bowers, who yelled, 'Death to all Jews,' as he was wheeled into the hospital." In this Facebook post, Ari Mahler describes the antisemitism he experienced growing up. He talks about the compassion that he felt for Bowers as he was assisting in saving his life. And it seems that anger was part of his experience, but did not have a place in that moment. And when asked why, how he could do that, how he could commit, He said, love. That's why I did it. Love as an action is more powerful than words. And love in the face of evil gives others hope. It demonstrates humanity. It reaffirms why we're all here. The meaning of life is to give meaning to life. And love is the ultimate force that connects all living beings. If my actions mean anything, love means everything. And now we have a congregational hymn, congregational song. This is by Jason Shelton, who I understand came here to visit sometime recently. Maybe you sang this with him at the time, I don't know. It's called Love Break Our Hearts. The words are in your order of service. There's only one line, you'll pick up on it really quickly. It's a short piece which we will repeat a bunch of times. Bill and I will start, and we'd like you just to come in when you begin to feel comfortable singing with us.
Michelle Zunter describes herself as a perpetually curious human, artist, writer, podcaster, mom, stepmom, and wife living in California. She writes blogs about love, sex, relationships, marriage, divorce, parenting, step-parenting, women's issues, and many, many more. And she says, a revolution of empathy needs to begin in our individual homes. The expression of compassion, acceptance, and the capability to show empathy needs to become the foundation for raising children surrounded by intolerance. Home environments where a child can feel secure in expressing their curiosity about different races, religions, or lifestyles has to be created and secured. It's a process which can have everlasting positive effects on the generations to come. A child should be able to have their questions about different cultures and lifestyles answered in a manner that does not include disgust, rejection, or tones of absolute judgment. This is where it all begins, in the home. The seeds of empathy for other human beings are planted in the living rooms, bedrooms, and kitchens across this nation and the world.
The final song in this presentation, Finding Home, with lyrics by Tina Landau, music by Ricky Ian Gordon.
Finding Home.
Thanks.